Little Foo Fighters there. And you know, the story of that song is, hey, something's falling apart. Some of my relationship's not going well. I can tell, I can see that there's something broken, but I'm not sure what it is. And then seemingly things get worse, and I didn't see it coming. Didn't really see what happened or how to fix it. I don't know if you ever noticed, but you ever noticed that really smart people can really miss out on obvious things? You ever notice that really smart people in these areas can be really oblivious in this area? I've noticed that because I am that, right? There's so many ways in which, boy, I can be so wise or so smart in some areas, but other areas, man, I can make some dumb decisions. Or I just don't see it. Like a glass, like in that last song, The Glass. It's like I can't see my reflection nearly as well as other people can see my own weaknesses. I think I'm seeing through the circumstance, but it's actually been distorted by the warp of how I'm seeing things and how I think I'm seeing things, obviously. Today I want to talk about why is it that even as a smart person, we can often miss what's right in front of us. We can't distinguish that which is real from that which is fake. Right? It looks similar, but it's not similar. So how do we develop a discerning palate? A discerning palate that's able to taste the complexity in every glass. A good wine has certain complexity. But in order to understand that, you have to develop a discerning palate. That is true about wine, it's true about life. How can we, even though we're wise in other areas, have we really developed a discerning palate for discerning our own reflection? Do we have a taste for the things that really help us look at the inner world in our life? Years ago, I had a father who came to me and was concerned about his son. His son was a very high-powered, very successful executive, and he started noticing things about his son. Some over-drinking, maybe, some things in his marriage that wouldn't be helpful. And then just a few months later, his wife came to talk to me, and the same thing. I got real concerns. I'm really worried about words like this, but every time I try and bring it up, every time I try and even barely broach the topic, he just gets very angry and very defensive. And here were two people who had access to all kinds of data that might be helpful to a guy who was a high-end leader. The guy could take the hill and had a history of taking the hill, but in his personal life, he wasn't able to see into the glass because he hadn't developed a discerning palate for the inner things, the personal things that really matter. I want to talk about three tastes today that we can develop because, man, I've done that. I'm sure my wife and kids would say that about me in many areas. How can I develop a discerning palate? A taste for, number one, a taste for teachability. It's one of the things they don't really teach you to learn about or to create a taste for, but it's probably one of the most successful things that determines your success in life. Can you be teachable? So what is teachable? How do you develop a taste for being teachable? Well, it says, I know what I don't know. A lot of people know what they know, but do you know what you don't know? And you're open to feedback in all areas. The areas you're good in, you're open to people who could take it from good to great. The areas that you're weak in, the areas that you don't even know you're weak in, you got a blind spot in. You're like, I'm open to feedback in all areas. I want to presume I have blind spots, and I want to develop a taste for being teachable. Because if you don't develop a taste for being teachable, you actually develop a taste for these habits of dismissiveness and excusing, and you actually blind yourself to other important data when you don't create a taste for teachability. In this series, we've been looking at old proverbs. This is a proverb from 1000 BC. This is a piece of ancient wisdom. It's been passed from every continent in the world across all times and centuries about how to be wise, how to have sage advice in your life is how you think, versus how to have jester or foolish. And these two characters show up over and over again in this wisdom. And this particular idiom or proverb says, a fool despises his father's instruction, but he who receives correction is prudent. Now, the original version of this was written in Hebrew, and there's little nuances that come out in the original language. There's two words for fool. One is somebody who's foolish because they don't have an experience. It's a way of saying, I'm inexperienced at that, right? It's not belligerent, it's just, I just haven't done it before. It's a different word here. This is a fool who is willfully belligerent. I'm shutting down feedback, I know better, I don't need to hear that. And that person, a foolish person, a jester person, despises, which means to not value your father's instruction. You ever got frustrated at your kids when they don't value your instruction, even when they're 50 and you're 80? Even when they're 20 and you're 45? At whatever age, you don't grow out of this. You develop a taste for this. On the other hand, did you often despise or not value your parents' instruction the way you probably should have? Yeah. And do you notice that sometimes you can start, it's like amazing, you come home from college, you're in your 20s, you get done with college plus, and you're like, man, my parents have learned so much. Maybe, or maybe you become a little bit more teachable and coachable. Now notice what he says, if a foolish person doesn't value his father's instruction, the contrast is a wise person is one who receives not just instruction, but who values, receives, counts as valuable, someone's correction. Do you have a taste? Have you developed a discerning palate for actually longing for correction because you see the value in your life personally and professionally? Sometimes we do it professionally, but we don't see it personally. And that person is prudent, which is a really interesting word in Hebrew. It means someone who's clever at navigating life. Do you want to be clever at navigating life? I do. Then you've got to value correction. A wise person can learn from good feedback, but also can learn from their enemies. Also can learn from people who didn't say it the right way or weren't nice about it because you so value getting accurate information. So in our real metaphor, how we think, what keeps someone from being teachable, from developing that? Well, often, the light switch gets hit, negative feedback comes in your life from your spouse, from your kids, from your boss, whatever, and what comes out of you is defensiveness or dismissiveness. And you've seen this in other people. It's a lot easier to see in others than yourself. And that person has a false confidence, right? Right? They're falsely confident in dismissing your feedback because they don't have access to the feedback. They have poor discernment because they don't even know how to hear stuff that doesn't already coincide with how they see themselves. They can't and won't see the consequences in their outlook. So what's going on in my head when that happens and in your head when that happens? And how could we change that real? Well, for the foolish person, when feedback comes into your life, what goes in your mind is, I know better. I know better than that. I think I'm more experienced than. I'm good. I'm covered. You know it. I don't think I need to hear that from you. That can't be true. That's one thing that goes through our head. You can imagine that makes you dismissive. Another thing that I find in me is when I get criticized, if I feel like I am my work and I am my effort, it's very hard to not get defensive because you're not just criticizing my work, you're criticizing me. Unless I can separate who I am, my identity, from my work, I'm going to be pretty defensive. A wise person says, no, I want to stay curious. Oh, I'm getting defensive, I'm getting angry, but I'm going to stay curious. There might be some nugget of truth here. Even though they're not saying it in the nicest way, I certainly could have said it at a better time, I'm going to be open to the good feedback hidden in the bad circumstance. And often you have to remind yourself, I am not what I do. This isn't personal. It's not against me. It feels personal. I'm going to learn because I am not what I do so that I can be criticized over here and not get so defensive. These are ways you can think about that to value it. Adam Grant, in his book, Think Again, talks about how corporately, personally, as leaders, that is such an important concept and the stakes are high. He gives an example in his opening chapter, a true story in 1949, I believe. There was 15 smoke jumpers. These were parachuters, firemen who were coming in to take care of this horrible fire in Montana at Man Gulch. They jumped into the situation. They had a foreman there who had a lot more experience with out-of-control forest fires. As they landed, they're all packed up with their chainsaws and their axes, and they're running uphill, and the wind comes in and just takes an already horrific fire and soups it up even more. The foreman who'd seen this before says, that's it, guys. We're not going to be able to stop this fire. We're actually in danger of our lives. Drop all your equipment. Run as fast as you can up the hill. Many of them, who were very experienced firemen, just had never seen this circumstance, said, I'm not dropping my axe, and I'm not dropping my chainsaw, I'm gonna need this to get out of here. Well, because they didn't drop it, it slowed them enough down that the fire consumed them because they couldn't outrun it. The other 10 that were left began running, and the foreman suddenly realizes, fire moving in both directions, we are not getting out of here, we only got one way, we're gonna get out of here. He sets a control fire right where he's standing, and he burns it outward, about 20 yards, 40 yards in all directions. You don't start a fire when there is a fire. Then he takes a wet cloth, he puts it over his face, and he literally, in the middle of forest fire, lays down in the middle of the circle he just burned. Everyone's like, that is the dumbest, craziest thing I've ever seen. They began to keep running up the hill, and every one of them died, or two of them had extremely severe damages to their body. The only man who survived was that foreman, who had the experience in that circumstance, under pressure, said, I don't want this to be the case, but this is the only way I know to get out of the circumstance. And he survived because when the fire burned over top of him, if you can imagine that, that 20-yard radius he burned created just enough window where there wasn't anything burning close enough that he could still breathe. And in his book, he goes on to say that many times in circumstances, we keep using what we did before. We don't see people of wisdom who are greater than us, and therefore we're not teachable, and the consequences can be dire for us, for our company, for our marriages. We got to learn how to think again, develop a discerning palate for new information. The second taste is a taste where I'm going to call a targeted tongue. If you're a wine connoisseur, you know, better than me, because I'm not particularly good at it, that you can taste the difference between the sugar and the acidity and the tannins and how those all come together. You've had to learn how to get a targeted tongue to realize these three things in particular combination speak to where it was grown, the type of vine it is. Is this from France? Is this from out west? You have to target your tongue to develop that discerning palate for that kind of wine. And what this proverb is going to tell us is that there's a certain way in which the wise person can see that inner flourishing and outer flourishing are connected, like the acidity. And that's connected to your wise mouth. How I use my words is part of that inner and outer flourishing as well. I learn how to target myself to see all these combinations. Here's how he says it. In the house of the righteous, that's the wise sage, a righteous person, there is much treasure. Wise people know how to save. Wise people have treasure and assets. Wise people know how to have outward success and flourish externally. In contrast, the revenue, what's the word revenue? The consequences of the wicked is trouble. However, the wicked person, the foolish person, doesn't see that his trouble is connected. It's the revenue, it's the payout of bad decisions they've made. They don't see it. A wise person can see, oh my goodness, this has happened because of this. I need to change course. I need to change action. The wise person sees the revenue or consequences of their actions are because of something they might be able to modify. Not the foolish person. He's oblivious to the consequences or the revenue of his actions. And it builds on that, and it says, the lips of the wise disperse knowledge. That there's a connection not only between my revenue, my outward flourishing, but also to the way I use my mouth, the way I talk to people, the way I talk in my marriage, the way I interact with my kids. Now, the foolish person doesn't see that. Ah, my kid's fault, it's their fault, it's always everybody else's fault. They don't see that how they use their lips and how their lips are connected to their inner flourishing and their outer flourishing. They don't see the connection there, and therefore they miss out on lessons learned and changes. You see, while the lips of the wise disperse knowledge, the heart, and in Hebrew, the word heart means the inner world. The inner world of the fool doesn't do that. The inner world of the fool only can point fingers at other people. It doesn't see my lack of revenue, my lack of treasure in life, both relational treasure and financial treasure, might be tied to my own inner world and the way I express that through my mouth. And targeting your tongue says, my inner world, my outer world, as well as my tongue, they're all connected. They bring this blend that I need to have a discerning tongue toward if I want to taste the complexity of life, the complexity in every glass. And yet no one's going to say, I don't want to see consequences. No one says that. No, even the foolish person doesn't know they can't see consequences. So what goes on in our brain that keeps us from seeing consequences? Well, again, the foolish person has a reel. And that reel is saying, you know what, I don't think I want to get too serious about this faith thing or this soulish thing or these flowery words because I'll lose my edge. My edge is not doing that. Or somebody brings feedback into your life and you're so concerned about protecting your image, how you see yourself, that you can't hear feedback that's not consistent with that image. So you don't see the consequences of refusing to see that feedback from a spouse or a friend or a boss or a company. You're so concerned about protecting your image that you can't get in touch with reality. The whole time people talking about this, maybe I've been talking about this right now, you're saying there's no revenue in the soft skills. There's no revenue in talking about your soul. Wishful thinking, that's kind of religiosity. I'm not sure it's even true. If you don't think there's any revenue in it, then of course you're not going to prioritize it and you're going to dismiss it. A wise person's different. A wise person is at least open. He knows that being good is the enemy of being great. I may be good in this area, but as Jim Collins says in his book, Good to Great, good is the enemy of great. I want to get to greatness, which means I got to be open to things I don't yet know. I got to be open that I may not be seeing everything I need to see. Good is the enemy of great. I am open here to feedback. I'm open to how outer flourishing and inner flourishing might come together. I'm open to teachability. In his book, Good to Great, didn't he say a level 5 leader uniquely combines the taste of ambitious goal setting and humility? It's not about them, it's about the goals. See, a wise person knows that humble people grow more because they have access to more feedback. Humble people know more because they don't dismiss feedback. Humble people connect better. Do you want to be married to someone who doesn't listen? Do you want to be raised by somebody who doesn't listen or understand? Do you want to be in a company with a boss who in no way takes feedback unless it's exactly what they already think? Of course not. Things don't flourish that way. You're going to lose good people that way. Humble people, confident people, but humble people grow more, know more, and connect better because of that. They see that unique combination of that. They know if you're going to target your tongue, you got to target your soul. Because what comes out of my mouth, like that fool, it begins with my inner world, my soulishness. I'm getting anxious or angry or upset because I don't know what's going on inside of me. I got to target my soul to target my mouth. I have a friend of mine who just interviewed a doctor in the last couple weeks. And the doctor was an atheist for most of his life. He's a brain surgeon. He wrote this book recently called The Immortal Mind by Michael Egnor. And his whole life, he basically believed human beings don't have a soul. That's a waste of time. It's not true. That's kind of wishful thinking by Christians. However, he's doing active brain surgery. And part of many of the surgeries he did is the person he's doing brain surgery on is awake. Can you imagine that? And so he's talking to the person while he's removing pieces of, large pieces of, their prefrontal cortex. And he does this over and over and over again. And he's like, I'm talking to someone while I'm taking out chunks of their brain. And they're interacting with questions. They're talking to me. And I realize I just took out, I'll make up the number, 1/16th, 1/32nd of their brain at their prefrontal cortex. It didn't impact them at all. He began to realize that his understanding of how the brain and the mind work was far more complicated than science and his atheistic view had told him. And the more he began to do brain surgeries, the more he began to realize he didn't fully understand that there was an immaterial portion of the mind that he didn't fully understand, even as an expert brain surgeon. So he begins to be open to there might be a soulishness connection that he needed to investigate, that he needed to check out, that he'd been too dismissive or defensive of. However, it didn't go very far except maybe curiosity, and then his wife got pregnant. And they were in the hospital, and as they were doing scans and ultrasounds, they discovered that their son had a brain anomaly. And he was terrified. He knew this particular brain anomaly was the kind of thing that you would raise a child that really didn't even know who you were. They would treat you like a piece of furniture. You're just like something in the room. They would never know you. He'd never know his child. And he was just, as a medical doctor who knew what this could mean, he was just scared out of his mind. He walks into the chapel. Hadn't been a chapel there at the hospital. He gets out of the chapel, and in his words, he says, I prayed something like this. God, if you're there, and I don't know if you are, you know I don't make a habit of praying, which I think is a great, honest prayer. And he says, God, I cannot handle it if I have a son who doesn't know me, ignores me, and treats me like a piece of furniture in the room. I don't know how to handle it. And he said, as an atheist, reaching out as close to an audible voice as I've ever heard, he said to me, how do you think I feel? I made you, I created you, and you've treated me like a piece of furniture you've ignored your whole life. Oh, hit him like a ton of bricks. He finishes this prayer saying, well, God, I want your help, and I'm going to change. I'm going to start looking into this soulish thing. I'm going to look into this. He ends up getting into a Bible study, studying the Bible, and science brought him to realize there was a soul, but the Bible helped him teach how the soul works. He becomes a follower of Jesus. He gets into a Bible study, and miraculously, his son was born, and despite what the medical report had shown, his son fully had no ramifications, had no medical problems, and he outlines all this in his book, The Immortal Mind. Uniquely how circumstances and medicine helped him see he needed to have a targeted tongue and realize that the soulish part of his life he dismissed was connected to the outer flourishing that we need. How's your discerning heart toward your own soul? Do you know when your soul is bitter or angry or frustrated or mad? Do you know that when you're talking, it might relate to what's going on the inside? Might it be time to investigate? Thirdly, a discerning palate is one who knows how to track your actions, but also track your inactions. And track your actions on the business stuff, which we're usually good at, the 5-year plans, the 10-year plans, but also track the inactions related to the things that matter most. Often we only track the actions in areas of work. We don't track it in, am I intentional about being a dad? Am I intentional about being a father? Am I intentional about being a wife? Are there ways I can grow in my understanding of my own soul, the bigger questions in life? Who am I? What's true? What really matters? A taste for tracking is also learning how to be disgusted at your inactions. I often dismiss or excuse my inactions. Here's what this proverb says. It continues. It says, the way of the wicked. Well, you mean just wicked people? No, people who are wicked, they got on a way. They got on a path. That path led them to do bad things. There's a way. There's a way of acting of the wicked. It's an abomination to the Lord. That's one of those words we don't use. But the word abomination means to loathe or disgust or to leave bad taste in your mouth. I don't know about you, but long before I get onto a path that leads to pain, I'd like to be disgusted by that path. Oh, I don't know. I'm not going down there. I've tasted that. I've tasted just a couple steps on that path. That's painful, right? I want to, even if my heart's leaning toward adultery, long before I end up in that path and the financial devastation and the kids crying and all the things losing my integrity, I'd like to have a bad taste in my mouth before I end up on that path, before I lead into temptation. And so part of that is having a taste for what is good and a distaste for what is bad. And not saying, well, it won't happen to me. And that's how we get onto that path. It won't happen to me. It won't hurt anyone, right? We don't have a distaste for those actions. It goes on to say, but the Lord, he loves him who follows, who puts action into righteousness. And look at that connection there. Your actions, what you follow, those actions, are connected to something that is right. You see, our actions can be connected to something that is good, or our actions can be connected to something bad. So the question is not, what actions do you have, but what are you aligning your actions to? And God is saying, if you align your actions to me, you'll be more free, you'll flourish better, you'll have less bitterness, more love, more peace. I want you to have a bad taste in your mouth toward that because it's not going to get you what you want. Have a good taste in your mouth toward tracking. This is the kind of stuff. When I align my decisions to this path, things get better and freer. I was talking to a friend here in Cincinnati about 2 weeks ago. We were talking about freedom. And I said, is liberty the freedom to do what you want, or is liberty the freedom to do what's right? He said, whoa, that's kind of deep. Well, think about it. Is liberty the freedom to do whatever you want? Or is liberty the freedom to do what is right? Let's start with the first one. Do you know people who've done whatever they wanted and they ended up less free? Like, no, God's not going to stop you. I'm not going to stop you from being bitter. Do whatever you want. Be as bitter as you want. Keep telling that story. Keep holding that bitterness for another 10 years. Is being bitter and aligning yourself to bitterness, is that making you more free or less free? Is that helping you flourish as a person and in your marriage and in your company? Is flourishing happening when you're giving over to whatever you want? I want to be as angry and bitter as I want to be. Or do you get less free? Are there certain desires that when you give into every indulgence and every appetite, appetite to anger, appetite to lust, if you do whatever you want, are you going to be more flourishing, more free, or less? Right, we know many of us have habits, we have areas of our life. It's like, I gave into that, and oh my goodness, it became all consuming, and I end up less free when I did whatever I wanted. I need to align my appetites to this path, and so I wouldn't do that. Oh. Ambition's a great thing, but ambition not aligned to something good, and you end up being ambitious, and you lose your health, you lose your hobbies, you lose a marriage, you lose yourself. Because it became all consuming, I need to align my ambition to something right, some path. Well, that begs the question then, if freedom is the freedom to do what's right, then what is that right thing you're aligning to? And what if there was a God who loved you, like it says he loves? What if there's a God who proved that by dying for you? You say, I don't know if I believe that. Well, you might want to check it out. If there was a God and he did die for you, and he does say, I got some ways to live life that makes you flourish, certainly worth checking out, wouldn't it? I know for me, I often track the actions of the things I care most about, and I don't track the things and inactions of the things that should matter the most. When's the last time you were able to track, where are you at in your spiritual journey? When's the last time you really tracked your ability to connect with the bigger questions? Who am I? What happens when I die? What's right? What's wrong? What's the solution to life? The big five questions everybody asks, are you tracking yourself to answer those or at least be curious about those? Like, why is it that it's so easy to prioritize this category and not even talk about that one? It's really what we're about as a church. We want to comfortably connect people to God through the Bible and a community growing Christ followers. We want to help you track with your journey, to help you discover where you're at in your faith. In fact, last year, we've been kind of tracking with where we are as a church, and so it's been kind of fun because really, as we look back over those 15 years, we're like a four-generation church now. And so we're trying to help kids track and babies track and everybody kind of track in that process. And it's really been fun to see so many people have found that when you align yourself to God, our student ministry is exploding as students are saying, man, I start to align my appetites toward God and I just find more joy, less depression. I find more fulfillment, more peace. It's been amazing to see how this works at every age and every place. So let me tell you a cool story. This jumps us back 15 years, a little tracking from the past, a tracking to the future. About 15 years ago, maybe 17 years ago now, we decided to ask the church to brainstorm how to create a place that would help people feel invited to connect with God. So I remember I met not by this lake you see, there's another lake out back. We thought the church was going to be back on that lake at the time. And so we had a blank post-it board, just white, and we had everybody brainstorm what they thought might be great to create a place where people could just develop a taste for God and for his word. So we collected these post-it notes from all these meetings we had, lunches and small group meetings and big group meetings I had sitting out there with people parking their cars. It was really fun because as we were tracking that process together, somebody wrote down, we would like it to feel like a church. It'd be great if our new property could have green space and nature. It would be fun if we could have like press boxes where people could meet in, observatories, a baptism, a terrace. Maybe the baptism could feel like a pool in people's backyard like we originally had, went to people's homes. Comfortable seats and auditoriums and large stage areas. If we could have like a fountain, a play set. So we handed all those post-it notes to the architect, kind of tracking with where we're doing, tracking what we were hoping. Now, there were a lot of ideas that were given that we didn't use. A monorail. Submarines. There was a lot of 10-year-old boys there that day. A regatta. So maybe you've heard me tell that story, what we did 17 years ago. And I guess it's been part of the story that we tracked together to be where we are and to build what we built. But actually, that story can now be your story. We are now going to move into what's called the ideation phase for the next month or so at the church. So we have hired an architect, MSA, here in town, and they specialize in auditoriums and building, not, in churches and spaces for children and students. We are out of space in both our first two services in the adult space. Because we're a four-generation church now and our student ministry is exploding, we have room for that. And so it was so much fun last time to brainstorm together. That's what we're going to do for the next month. We're going to brainstorm together. We want your ideas. If you want us to come meet with you, grab lunch with you, our team, if you want us to come and go to your small group, if you're in a small group, we'd love to be part of that. We're going to have some larger group meetings where I'll just gather everybody after a service and we're just going to post a note together. Some ideas we'll use, we want to hear everybody's idea. in what we're going to call this ideation phase. Then just like we did last time, we handed these post-it notes to the architect. Then they rendered this picture behind you. So later on, I took the post-it notes and I put it on the architectural plan to go, holy cow, the ideas we came up with is what the architect used to build this place. So actually, who built the church? Who designed the church? We all did. We get a chance to do that again together, and we're very excited about that process. And I hope you are too. If you're like, I trust you, you guys are good, then that's fine. There'll be a time in the new year when we'll have an invitation stage to invite people to give. But right now, we're in this really fun ideation phase. Many of you know I mentioned maybe 3 or 4 months ago that we would be building a glass conservatory where the tent is right about 2 weeks ago. We had technical difficulties related to some coding and technical stuff, and so we've had to delay that until next spring. The good news is, because we've hired an architect, instead of building a relatively quick facility that can be put on there, we're going to actually have the full architect design that conservatory with all the things we talked about, glass, be able to see in, the nature, a place for big meeting rooms and small groups and gathering spaces. But we now get a little bit more window of time to brainstorm. So if you have ideas for our tent, for those of you who love the tent outside, how we can make that a more permanent structure that represents our building, we're talking to the architects about that. Children's space, small group space, it's just really going to be a fun time like it was 17 years ago. We're tracking. For our first two services, if we have too much inaction, we're going to be in trouble. We're already growing and amortizing out the problem of not having space for kids and grandkids who are coming in the building. So we're trying to do what we're talking about here, which is track our actions, but also track the challenge of our inactions if we don't. So how about for you, whether it's related to business or marriage or your own spiritual connection or your own inner sense of soul and self, give yourself a taste test. Give yourself a taste test. Take a look in the mirror and maybe ask yourself not what you would say to yourself, right? Because I lie to myself all the time. What would your kids say? Would they say that you have a taste for teachability? I have a big ego. Well, maybe it's time to develop a discerning palate. What would your spouse say? What would your last couple of reviews say? Would they say that you have a teach for being coachable and teachable in all areas of your life? Take a taste test. How about that targeted tongue? Have you ever wondered or even connected that maybe there's a connection between my outer flourishing and my inner flourishing? If not, what might a taste test be like if I began to develop a discerning palate for that? Are you tracking actions in your life? But what about inactions? Have you ever weighed the cost or tasted the cost of not being active in discovering who am I, who are we, what really matters, what happens when you die? There's actually a cost in not knowing what your purpose is. Maybe you want to develop a discerning taste for that. Time to look in the mirror and say, I want to be more open. The band's going to come out and do a song you've probably heard many times, but I really like you to use this song as a chance to not just hear the song, but to be challenged by the song. The song's going to mention change. It's going to mention your soul. But it's really, I think, an opportunity for us to say, okay, where am I? If I took that taste test today, it's not like the Pepsi challenge back today. My taste is, am I as discerning in my palate toward these inner qualities as I am toward a fine wine? Let's take a moment and look in the mirror. You know, change is easier to talk about than it is to do, isn't it? All of us want to be wise. It's just a lot of those jester mindsets are stuck in us. Maybe you want to invite God to be part of that process. God, I want your wisdom. I want your help. I do want to make some changes, whether it's letting go of bitterness or letting go of some appetites, not getting stuck in some ditches. What if you had access to the wisdom of the ancients and the wisdom of God? Let's pray together and ask for that. I just want to start, and like that doctor said, God, sorry, I've been treating you like a piece of furniture. Sorry, I haven't really prioritized you as my dad. Please forgive me. Thanks for dying on the cross for me. I want to be open to feedback about how I think, how I act. Would you help me be teachable and coachable as a leader, as a friend. Help me understand my own soul. In Jesus' name, amen.